Welcome to New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. Each week I try to present the latest in a spiritual revolution that's happening in this country, and tonight's guests will be are part of that, bringing truth, a greater evolution of consciousness to the planet. My first guest is Michael Horn, who's produced this very exciting new movie, The Silent Revolution of Truth, about the Billy Meier case in Switzerland, which is probably the best documented, the most incredible pictures of UFOs anyone's ever taken anywhere. And Michael is going to be premiering this film in New York on Thursday night, January 31st. I'm producing and sponsoring this event, and I welcome people to come down to the Meta Center. That's 214 West 29th Street on the 16th floor, $15. Be there at 7 p.m. If you have any questions, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. This is Alan Steinfeld. And Michael, are you on the line?
It must be me. I can hear you.
There you go. I actually didn't see the whole film, but what I saw of it is very well produced. I was sort of saving it for the premiere, but
great.
Did you edit the thing yourself?
We had a German editor, and we worked with him, and it was a side-by-side production all the way with my director, Jack Gerler, and myself, and I'm the writer, producer, and creative consultant to the film, and I'm in there a little bit myself.
Right. I mean, it sort of is told around from what I saw, your point of view, in a sense.
You know, it turned out to be like a road trip, really. Once we'd gone to Switzerland, and then we were back here in California, and then we went to Nevada, and there was a presentation, and we interviewed, you know, lots of people, and as you said, the most remarkable, you know, photographic and physical evidence of any UFO case in history.
But you must be proud of this product, too, because it's a very well-done product, the film.
Well, thank you. I actually am, and my partner is as well, and the reason we are is because we didn't want to do any kind of typical production. We wanted something that would be direct and that would be well done, and we spent a considerable amount of time and energy and you know what to get it to that level.
Stuff, yeah, right. But tell me then, I mean, in the film you talk about how you just were sort of immediately fascinated by Billy Meier. I mean, what actually went through your mind when you saw these pictures for the first time?
Well, actually, the first time I saw them, and I say to people, this is not obviously what I based my conclusions on almost 30 years later, but the first time I saw them in a photo book in 1979, my reaction was, that's real. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, it rang true, and I bought the book and studied it as much as I could until I could come into possession of the next actual evidence, the conversational transcripts. But looking at his photographs and reading, and just looking at the man and the people and the environment as was, you know, portrayed in that book, I thought, you know, this is the real deal. And I have spent, as I said, nearly 30 years in every aspect of research and investigation that I could, as well as, of course, reviewing all of the official investigations that were done by the original team in the late 70s and early 80s, and I've met everybody I could involved, of course.
Who did that? Was that the elders? Who did that officially?
Yeah, Lee and Britt Elders.
The Japanese were also there, too, right?
Yes, at some point, I'm trying to remember his name. It'll come to me, Yuichi or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But it was Wendell Stevens was actually the lead member of the investigative team. And he is the man that was really responsible for this whole thing going forward as an investigation. The elders, Lee and Britt Elders, were the two major skeptics in the whole deal. They were they're professional electronic countermeasure specialists, you know, counter-espionage. And they work very, very high-level commercial, corporate, government types of cases, and their first instinct was this had to be a hoax, and they were going to kind of protect Wendell from being taken in. And then things unfolded over the next several years that they witnessed themselves. And
what did they actually witness?
Britt Elders actually saw a being, and we're not sure if it was an extraterrestrial human or an android type being, outside of her window one night. They saw a light stuff in the sky that was consistent with what was called the light energy ship. They were around when other strange things were happening, and I think Wendell has written and spoken about it. I mean, Wendell was virtually living with the Meyer family off and on for 8 years during the investigation. At one point, Billy got the telepathic message to go for a contact. It was a rainy night. It was a miserable night. And he bundled himself up because Billy was going off on a moped at this time, this one-armed guy driving a moped through the Swiss countryside in all kinds of weather and hours of the day and night. So he heads out the door, and Wendell, he said he was maybe 3-4 steps behind him. Billy opened the door, stepped out. Wendell walked through the door, and he saw 2 footprints, and that was it. Billy was completely gone.
Was he teleported?
He was beamed up into their ships, and it was on an occasion like this, or this occasion as well, where when the people, he would take with him a walkie-talkie. This is way before cell phone days and computers and stuff, and he would call the people in the house or wherever to come and pick him up someplace, wherever the Pleiaran people decided to set him down.
They'd leave him back at home? Hey, drop me off at home, guys?
Well, that would happen, but not all the time. Sometimes they would drop him a great distance away, and I think it was rather clever, because rather than it being something where Billy could be some kind of a trickster, they'd drop him 20 kilometers away on a rainy night. People would go to that destination, and suddenly Billy would be walking towards the car, and his clothing was completely dry, and it was just beginning to spot up from the rain falling. While his friends have come to pick him up, and they're going, well, wait a minute, how is this possible? It's a downpour, and if this guy somehow got 20 kilometers away, he can't be dry. So it was...
It's true. Some amazing things happen to him. I mean, and the film, in a sense, is more an overview of who he is and his life than about UFOs, although there are some truly remarkable... I mean, these are probably the pictures everyone steals when they want to picture a UFO somewhere, right? I mean,
and this is what's funny to me, if it's funny in that sense, is that all this fuss gets made periodically about lights in the sky or a sighting over O'Hare Airport or in Texas.
Well,
or
just
something.
Recently in Texas.
And you get nothing. So people have seen something in the sky, more than likely, in my opinion, U.S. secret military craft. But they draw conclusions that this is all from outer space and all that. Meanwhile, like you said, in this film, we show the most remarkable, clear, unambiguous, photos and films and video and sound recordings and metal samples, all from the evidence that Meyer himself gathered, and it drives people crazy. The skeptics go nuts.
Well, there is one thing I wanted to ask you about, because he has pictures looking out of the UFO window, but how come he never turned that camera around and photographed the inside of a UFO?
Actually, there is one photograph that I've seen on the inside, but I don't consider it definitive, because I think it could be argued, well, maybe this was set up in some kind of a facility with a space-age-looking console and an unusual screen. And I don't have that photo. A friend of mine in South Carolina actually has it. And I thought, okay, well, you know, let's give people the hardest stuff to debunk. And when you've got those photos that you see looking out of a craft at 2 other disks above the ground, and you can see the ground and you can see 2 other UFOs clear as day out a window or some kind that Meyer took from inside the craft, you've got to go, now, wait a minute. It's 1976 or 77, and a one-armed farmer is coming up with hundreds of these things in the middle of nowhere.
I mean, he'd have to be some kind of genius to even attempt to fake like this.
Yeah, you're right.
But, and why would he want to? I mean, he's living in the middle of nowhere. He's not probably making much money off of this, or has he made money off of this?
No, and I'll tell you, as people will find out, this man has had 21 attempts on his life. There's no payoff for him here.
Who's doing that? Who wants to kill him?
Well, a lot of people who of a religious persuasion, a number of people from secret services of different countries, and there was also an involvement from a hostile ET group or two that wanted to eliminate him for very, very ancient reasons.
So are the Pleiadians protecting him?
Initially, during the early contacts in the 70s, and let's remember that his contacts actually started in 1942, but during the 1970s, from 75 on, when he went public with this in the most dramatic and consistent way, they offered him some protection for a period of time, but basically they turned it over to him. They said, you're going to have to take care of yourself. We can't be here to deflect every bullet. And indeed, Wendell Stevens was sitting with him when a bullet just missed his head because Meyer inexplicably fell forward simultaneously with a rifle shot. And things like this are, and I don't know if you've seen it yet in the film, he does speak about one of the assassination attempts and shows what he used to thwart it and how his dreams play a part in protecting him. And this is a very interesting man. He's a very grounded individual.
How old is he now?
He'll be 71 on this, I think, on Saturday or Sunday.
And this has been going on since the 60s, right?
No, since 1942 when he was 5 years old is when it started.
Yeah, but the first time he said
first,
in the 60s.
Yeah, the first photos were taken in 1964 in India, in the middle of nowhere again, outskirts of a small village where there was an ashram that he was studying Buddhism at. And I don't know if you've seen it yet in the film, but you will. There's an interview with someone that you know who had been at that ashram at the time.
Right,
and
right.
We also, we've brought some very interesting ingredients into this production. People who could give, skeptical viewpoints, people who give psychological therapeutic viewpoints, and even an expert consultant from the U.S. Army Special Forces who teaches reading body language. And let's remember, he's teaching it to people who have to be able to make split-second decisions on truthfulness and safety and, you know, how to read a person. And he sits and analyzes both Meyer and this other witness, mm-hmm. contactee, to these experiences in India.
Wow. So how did he lose his arm then? And how come he wasn't protected?
Well, more than not being protected, he was told about it years in advance. He was told that at one point, I think they said to him, in about 10 years, you're going to lose your arm. And you're going to have to learn to get used to it and to live your life with only one hand. And not only that, but the tasks that are going to be on your plate from that point on are going to be monumental and far exceed anything you've done up until the point that you lose your arm, which has proved to be true.
So what happened to him?
Okay. Well, we do tell the story in the film.
He did tell in the film, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he does, too. I'll leave that a little bit because you hear it from the man himself. And just to say that after, this is something, I don't know that I said it in the film, but after the man loses his arm, let's remember he's taking these interesting UFO photos in India in 1964, up to 8 ships, and we show them, of course. Mm-hmm. And then in 75 on, after he only has one hand, the quantity and quality and variety of physical evidence increases exponentially in terms of hundreds and hundreds of photos, up to 3 and 4 of the ships in a photo. He's got 8 film segments. We show one with a UFO hovering above his head with 3 different UFOs moving independently in a clear day, a UFO disappearing behind a hill. This is all from the 70s. And, I took these films and photos to a company called Uncharted Territory. This is where I got to do my own first-hand, let's show it to the experts thing that haven't seen it. And these are the people that won the Academy Award for Special Effects for Independence Day. They know their stuff. Mm-hmm. And I showed them the photos, and I showed them the films, and I said to the guy, is this film here, is this a model? I basically could almost not complete the word, and they burst out laughing, the 2 owners. And one of them said, that's not a model. We know models. That's not a model. And I said, well, the skeptic said it's a model, and that Billy scratched a negative with a pin to make these lights go on. Broad daylight. Great footage. And they said, no, we understand. We know all those techniques, and we know models. That's not a model. I said, well, could you duplicate that? And one guy looked at the other, and then he turned, and he said, well, if we could do it, we have to go to CGI. When was the film done? I said, no later than 1978. And the guy laughed. He says, well, we have to go to computers for that kind of stuff.
So, well, then they must have been convinced that this was real. I mean, they knew what they were looking at.
Well, I think they do know. I've sent them a copy. I'm waiting for them to, of the film. I want to hear back from them probably after I get back from visiting you folks in New York.
But is he still having these contacts now?
Yes.
Like still weekly, daily? What's
well, I'm not exactly sure. I know that at some points they are at least monthly and sometimes weekly or bi-monthly.
Mm-hmm.
And they
Same
are
people.
Face-to-face, voluntary, in the office. And sometimes he actually goes off with them someplace or other, gets beamed up.
Well, he's been to other planets.
Yeah, he's been to other parts of the universe. He's been to other times. Again, allegedly, this is for people to decide for themselves. And
right, but it must be so weird then to come back to Switzerland, live in the in the sticks, really. And,
the sticks are pretty beautiful there, actually. But I'll tell you, Alan, you hit the nail on the head in another way. I was talking to Bill, this is about 2-3 years ago, about it, and I said, so I was asking about the Play Aren people, and he said, well, the difference is that they are true human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at him, and he said, you know, every time I'm with them to come back, it's very hard each time to have to come back to this world. I mean, you know, we live in the cities here. He's living in a part of Switzerland where they've worked their land like nothing on earth. They planted 10,000 trees. It's spectacular. But the difference between this world and the generically, you know, overall the mass consciousness here and these people is beyond night and day.
So why doesn't he stay there? I mean, why does he have to come back?
He doesn't have to. It's his self-obligated mission. It's his duty. It's funny, I'll tell you something. The first thing I ever heard him say, in 2000, I think it was, I went over for the first time to visit. And I went over there and met a buddy who I'd never met otherwise on just through the Internet. And we tripped in. He was from Texas. And we got over there and we're walking up to the house after we'd kind of woken up from our jet lag. And suddenly Billy kind of bursts through the door with some books under his arm and his keychain. And my friend Mark, kind of a big personality, said, Billy, I just want to tell you on behalf of all the people, and, you know, he starts, and Billy just looks at him, he reaches out his hand to Mark, and he says, don't mention it, it's my duty. And he marches on his little way. And when he said that, to me, it embodied so many of the actual, you know, teachings of all times where there were philosophies that pertain to the most noble thing a person can do is to fulfill their calling in life, to fulfill their duty, to not seek fame and fortune and ego gratification, but to respond to the inner knowing of what they are here to do. And
well,
that's what he does.
Well, you know, you've been with him in person. Does it feel like being with a spiritual teacher? Is he that level of intensity?
Well, this is what's so interesting about Billy. And I've, over the past 7 years, this will be the 8th year I go over there, I've visited him already with him 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
He is probably, I would just say, the most balanced person, the most neutral person, without being boring by any stretch of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But he does not project the smiley guru, hello, I'm here, everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't fawn over people. He doesn't resist. The first time I ever met him, we were outside. I was coming over there to do some work and stuff, and he asked me to come over for a second. He was asking me about something, and I was responding. And the feeling I had inside was very unique. I was aware that while my mouth was moving and I was answering a question, that I felt no defensiveness from him and no defensiveness in me towards him. It was like, this guy kind of knows me. There's no show that I have to do here. And I've always felt that with him, and I've seen it with everybody I've seen him interact with, whether they were people he knew or not. He just brings he's present. And he's not dramatic about it, and he doesn't consider himself a guru or a master. He is simply the guy there that has the ability, who's learned how to be with these people vibrationally and how to be in this world vibrationally.
Mm-hmm.
And this
That's
is something,
exciting.
Yeah, it's just, and he's just too busy with life to be pretentious, I guess. It doesn't have any desire to be.
You're saying, though, he really is a sort of enlightened being, and so, I mean, from your,
Well, it's kind of in a way beyond that, and I'm not trying to,
I know, you're trying
what
to...
What I mean by that is this. We have bought in our world, in our spiritual vocabulary, we've accepted certain ideas, even about enlightenment and things like that, and I've always, even before this Meyer case, had trouble with the concept, and I kind of got supported in my understanding of it. Enlightenment, quote-unquote, is not an event, and it's not a state of being. It's a progressive on-off switch thing like everything else in life.
Mm-hmm.
We have various enlightenments. We have various awarenesses. And evolution in consciousness, which is very much what the case is about,
mm-hmm.
is a millions of lifetime-long process.
Mm-hmm.
So the status of the, quote-unquote, highest guru on the planet will be lower than a child 150 years from now. It's just
right.
The evolution.
I totally get that.
Yeah.
And the Pleiarians are pretty much living at another level of consciousness in general.
Yes, and they live a three-dimensional physical life with super high tech. However, they all have their own gardens that they work in with their hands. They don't lose touch with their own earth. The highest leaders in their societies are not politicians. They are people of spiritual and philosophical knowledge and wisdom, and they are obligated to the same contributions work-wise to the society as all other citizens. So they don't have hierarchies of celebrity and status and privilege. They have hierarchies of spiritual and development and philosophical wisdom development, but the obligation is always to those, quote-unquote, in quotes, believe me, below or beneath that level, to help people bring themselves up. So there is totally, this world is antithetical to that, because they operate on principle, we operate on advantage. Mm-hmm. And that's the
difference. Where is their planet?
They say that they are in the direction of, but not in, the Pleiades, about another 80 light years beyond the Pleiades in an altered time-space configuration, about a second and a half out of phase with our own dimension. But again, these are three-dimensional people. They have physical bodies. Their consciousness and their spiritual development are significantly beyond ours, but they still live human lives, because that's a huge part of creation and the obligation of humans at all levels of development.
But why are they here with us now on our planet?
Well, they are no longer here with us, though their bases had been here up until maybe 10 years ago.
They why still are they visiting us in these ships, though? Why are they...
Let's say the question is, you know, why did they come and what's this about? Well,
yeah.
It said early on in the material that this is for them a self-obligated mission to try to insert into our world in a manner that is not inflictive, invasive, or that calls forth too much attention to beings, per se, so that we don't start again the very reason they've come. And that is to help rectify the damage done by their own forefathers and others who represented themselves as the gods of our religions and holy books, and who set in motion the religions of today, in many cases, certainly the major ones, which now have everybody at each other's throats and which portend tremendous destruction and damage unless we get some essential clarity. And they've given some specifics. We'll talk about it at the film screenings as well.
Sure.
But the point definitely is they want to help rectify. And if reincarnation is a fact of life, as they say it, there's no reason to not contemplate that some of them on this particular mission may have played the part of these corrupting overlord gods and lords of 3, 5, or more thousand years ago.
So they feel it's their mission on behalf of sentient consciousness everywhere, even though whatever really happens here is, in a sense, none of their concern, because they're living their own life on their own planet. I mean,
to a degree, there's some concern that if we really got too destructive and could blow our planet apart, as had happened once before with another planet that's now the asteroid belt, that
right.
we would cause damage potentially in many places in this universe. However, I would actually say, in the simplest and most corny terms, it's an act of love. They see us as at an earlier stage that they themselves have to go through. They know that we are walking into and continually creating an enormous and unimaginable level of grief for ourselves unless a significant number of us wake up and take very specific action and think and feel and direct those thoughts and feelings in very specific ways. Otherwise, we, and especially this country, are facing cataclysmic destruction that's otherwise avoidable. And they make no, you know, they mince no words about it, and they spell it out. These are in the prophecies.
What should we actually do? What do you feel we should?
Well, I'd like to go into that a little more at, you know, the...
Well, we will. Just give a list here.
Okay, let me give you an overview in the simplest sense.
Yeah.
It is only through the thoughts, the feelings, and the resulting actions of human beings that we create our world and our reality. And this is not necessarily new thinking. However, the level that they deal with it at is very discreet, and it requires, in their estimation, a vigilance in thought observation that is unrelenting, that, you know, virtually 24 hours a day. I mean, do it in your dreams is their kind of, you know, advice as well. And an observation and editing and shaping of thought, and deciding consciously which thoughts that we are consciously running, usually unconsciously, we're going to continue to perpetuate, and which thoughts we are going to eliminate, and what new balanced thoughts not positive thinking, but neutral positive, meaning we have to recognize what a situation is, what the thinking is, what the feelings are, what's coming out of that. And then if we choose, once we recognize what is, we can choose what we prefer. We can't put affirmations and band-aids over the things that we have not come to terms with. So this is a slow, painstaking process, but ultimately the only way out of the mess. And then there are other more macrocosmic things, too.
Right, but that's a really nice, it's a very core spiritual teaching lots of people are saying these days. Which
yes, and
it can't
a
be
lot
said
of the,
enough, of course.
Yeah, and the thing is, there, truth is truth, and there is truth to be found in many teachings, even in religions and all that. I say even because the majority of religions, as the majority of many spiritual teachings, are simply filled out with other things that are not true and that take the time, the thought, the energy, and create beliefs and faiths and what have you in people that cannot be tested. They're not empirically valid and all of that. So there is no belief in the Meyer case. There are no beliefs whatsoever. And that's a really bizarre thing when you think about it.
What do you mean, no belief?
I mean you're not encouraged to believe anything. You're encouraged to struggle through the process of discovering what is true and what is not. Yeah, I've read several thousand pages of English transcripts. There's only one time in it that I heard anybody say, I believe. And that was when the so-called Pleiaran leader, Ptah, says to Billy, upon answering Billy, one of Billy's questions, he says, I believe the name of the woman you're thinking of is so-and-so in Austria. That's it. There's no beliefs. Because
so
belief,
it's knowledge and experience.
Yes, it's knowledge, yes. This is, we leave behind the age of beliefs for the age of knowledge. We support facts rather than speculation. We acknowledge that we do hold beliefs, everybody's got beliefs, but we should cease to be precious about them because if something's true, then we don't need to believe it anymore. We know it. If it's not true, we don't need to believe it anymore either. And there's no reason to be offended when people
right.
question beliefs. However, in our world, if you question or speak about religious or political beliefs, people get ruffled because they've been conditioned to it. Because these things haven't been thought through, they've generally been pounded into our poor skulls in one form or another.
No, it's a great... I didn't realize you were... actually such a spiritual teacher as well, and I think it's a great combination, opening people's eyes up to new phenomena like UFOs, like these, like Billy's experience, and the spiritual teachings that go along with it. It's a great upliftment.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm a quote-unquote spiritual teacher. I'd like to say that I'm a participant in this discovery, and what they have said is that we will teach by example, not just by blabbing. Maybe I can be a good speaker, and that's fine. I can share information. But we have to live these things, and all of us fall in and out of doing a good job of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you. So I'm going to be showing this film in New York with Michael will be present, and it's a premiere screening. I'm very excited about this on January 31st. That's this Thursday at 7 p.m. at the Meta Center, 214 West 29th Street, 16th floor, 7 p.m., email me if you want to come, newrealities@earthlink.net, and you can also order this film. Tell them how to order the film if they're not going to be able
to. Sure, all they have to do is go to TheyFly. That's my website. It's spelled T-H-E-Y, F as in Frank, L-Y, TheyFly.com, and there's plenty of information there. And we've tried to make what, Alan, I'm glad you could say objectively, is a really good production, affordable for people so that they can have something to study and contemplate for a long time to come.
Yes, and we're also showing the film on Long Island on February 1st, and then in Connecticut over the weekend. You can email that same number, newrealities@earthlink.net, that email. And then you're also going to be appearing at the Nevada UFO Conference. Where are you going to be?
Yeah, the International UFO Congress in Nevada. I'll be there on March 1st. I'll be there half the week up to that, and I'll be making a presentation on the case, and I'll be sharing new scientific information that has been corroborated since the film came out, and quite possibly I'll talk about that too at the New York events. And we've also had a skeptic who's been trying to debunk the case who's just accidentally proved it even more, much to his chagrin. And
there are some skeptics that say this is impossible, and they came up with all sorts of reasons to say it's not true, but you know, people always do that. You know?
They always do it, and we've taken them on. As a matter of fact, Alan, when you get to it in the special features, you'll see the skeptic trying to make his best case against the market. We gave him a sit-down opportunity to make a not even to be interviewed. We said, you go ahead, make your presentation. And he did, and I answered. But there's more things to say about that, too, and we finally have kind of taken the gloves off of these guys a bit. They are very unhappy with their own bumbling, but that's another story.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. I will see you tomorrow. I'm going to email you. I look forward to hanging out. And,
yeah.
And we'll, you know, take New York by storm. You know?
I love it. Let's go freeze somewhere. I love it.
No. So, if you have any problems, give me a call later, but I will email you.
Thank you.
And thank you.
My pleasure, Alan.
Informant. We'll be putting this interview up on my website, and also bbsradio.com will archive this.
Great.
Under New Realities, look for the date and archives, and you can link it to your website as well.
I'd like to, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for
thanks,
a great
Alan.
Job.
All right, now. Bye.
Okay. And my next guest was Michael Horn, the producer of The Silent Revolution of Truth, and you can order that film at www.theyfly.com. Really amazing story of the Swiss farmer Billy Meyer. This is the film about Billy Meyer's life, so I totally recommend it. And if you're in New York, definitely come down to the Meta Center on Thursday. My next guest is Jimmy Twyman. I'm sure people have heard of Jimmy Twyman. He was a singer, songwriter, did a film about Indigo Children. He is really at the forefront of this spiritual revolution that's happening in this country. His latest film is called The Moses Code, where he interviews a whole host of people about the teachings of Moses. Can we get Jimmy on the line? Back with New Realities, and for the second part of the show, I will be interviewing Jimmy Twyman with his latest movie, The Moses Code. Jimmy, are you there?
Yes, hi, how are you tonight?
Good, it's been a while since we connected, huh?
Yes, but
I'm so glad
to reconnect here.
I know. Last time I saw you was in Barcelona, I think, at the World Parliament.
Wow.
Was it?
It was a while ago, but that was such a powerful event, wasn't it?
It was incredible, but you've been pretty busy. You've done a few movies since then. You did the Indigo Children, right?
Yes, Indigo was the original. That was a feature film, and then we followed that up with another feature film called Into Me See, and then about 2 years ago, another film, a documentary on the Indigo Children called Indigo Evolution.
Oh, I saw the Indigo Evolution with that amazing, everyone talks about that young girl, the painter, a poet, right?
Yes.
Yes. What's happening with that girl now?
I think she's just moving on to bigger and better things. You know, I think she's probably the ripe age of 12 at this point, and I've seen some of her paintings of late, and it's just astounding that a child beginning at age 4 could exhibit such mastery as she does. But I think that's one of the gifts of the Indigos, is that they definitely represent a whole new level for humanity.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the Moses Code, because I saw part of it. I mean, you have an amazing cast of teachers, spiritual teachers. And
yes.
What inspired you to do this? I mean, and give us a little overview of the basis of the movie. Yeah.
Well, first of all, there were a number of things that inspired me, but one of them was the success of another film that has been circulating for a while, a movie called The Secret.
Yeah.
At this point, I think everyone and their mother has seen that film, and there's been a lot of talk and a lot of hype. And I have to say that when I first saw that film, I was both excited and also very scared. I was excited that there were so many people who were opening up to that message. And yet, at the same time, I knew that if it stopped where The Secret stopped, that we were all in very deep trouble. Because for so long now, there have been so many people who are promoting using spiritual laws to really and simply serve the constant desires and hunger of the ego. And the way that the Secret presented the law of attraction, it was really from that perspective. It was all about ego manifestation, or how do I get all the things that I think I don't have that will somehow fulfill my life.
Right, and there is a spiritual. I mean, we are living in a material world. You know, we are material beings in a sense. But
we are absolutely. But I really felt that we are finally ready for a message of much greater depth than the way it was presented. And I do honor The Secret for opening the door for a discussion to be made. But I think what is needed today. Desperately needed today, actually, is for us to begin moving away from this message of how do I constantly get the things that I want, and moving more into the deeper spiritual message of how do I use these laws to give, and in doing so, to be able to satisfy the longing of the soul rather than the ego. So that was really one of the jumping off points for the film, and it was actually Debbie Ford who bugged me long enough to make the film till I finally said yes. But what I did find was that there are so many teachers, almost all of the major teachers out there, wanted to be part of a project that would take this message much deeper.
Moses is associated with a very specific religion, people didn't have a problem with that aspect of Moses?
No, first of all, Moses is associated with three of the major religions, all of the Abrahamic traditions, and this is also a message that really transcends religion, I think, as we know it. I think the Moses Code really boils down to the message that I think we need today, which is how do we use these spiritual laws to achieve freedom, to change the world. Not just get things for ourselves. And I think Moses was the representative of that 3,500 years ago, and I think that message is coming around again today as we're being asked to do the same.
But, you know, there is this then movement that, you know, we're a part of, the movement away from religion back into spirit. And how do we talk to people who hold Moses and Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad in these idealistic places of greater than, you know? How do we reach those people?
Well, first of all, I would reframe that and say that we're not trying to move away from religion. What I would say is that we're trying to move into the heart of all of our spiritual traditions, which really is the message that we need today. Of course, as we know, so many of the religious traditions that many of us have been practicing over the centuries and millennia, many of the outer traditions have promoted separation, promoted polarity, and yet if we look at the heart of Christianity, the heart of Judaism, the heart of Islam, and all of the religions, we really see the same message of peace. So I think one of the things that we have to do is to not think that we're moving away from something, but to really reframe it and to know that we're moving toward. I think the problem with saying that we're moving away from something is even that adds to the polarization. It seems to exclude rather than include. And so I think one of the beautiful things about the Moses Code is that it includes all of it. It includes people who are practicing whatever religion they're practicing, as well as people like us who I think are more dedicated to the spirit that transcends all of those forms. So I'm hoping that this is a project that's going to grab and inspire everyone.
Well, yeah, no, but the thing about the center of all religions is that they have actually, I don't think we have to hold on to the old trappings and call something religion. I mean, this is my personal belief. I think many people are attached to the form, but I think what you're really saying is in the center of all the religions is the essence of spirit, which is what we are. So just my thing is why pretend? Why pretend to uphold the exoteric traditions that separate people when in the center of that are the things that unite people? I mean, I don't know.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah.
At the center of all of those religions is that uniting factor. And yet I'm not going to say to someone who's a practicing Christian, you shouldn't be a Christian anymore. Mm-hmm. What I would say is be the absolute best Christian you can possibly be, which is to follow the real heart of the teachings of Christ, not necessarily what has been taught by religions, but the message of love, the message of compassion. And when we do follow those messages, what happens is we find that it's really the same message that's at the center of all of them. So
yeah.
I personally don't think it's about inspiring people to leave their religion at all. I think that if someone wants to be a Muslim, a Buddhist, whatever it is, be a good Muslim, be a good Buddhist, whatever it is, live an inspired life that's directed by spirits, and you know, whatever direction you want to take, that's up to the individual.
Yeah, no, I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think it might be too soon to ask people to let go of their outer form because of the thousands and thousands of years of attachment people have had to those forms. But in essence, when I look at someone, I don't see a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew. I see a person, you know, and that's
right.
And I see the spirit coming through that person.
Right.
And
right.
So that's just me. And I think we're still a long way from changing the world and being emissaries of light in that way, you know. But you do have an amazing cast in this film. Now, how did you get everyone together, like Debbie Ford, Andrew Harvey, Joe Dispenza, who's an old friend of mine? I mean, what was it? What was the way you approached these people and got them all to kind of talk about
that? Well, it really wasn't that difficult, actually, because, as I said before, almost all of these people wanted to align themselves with a message that perhaps resonates with all the people who were inspired by the secret, but wanted to offer a deeper vision of the law of attraction. The Moses Code is about using the law of attraction. In fact, the subtitle to the book is the most powerful manifestation tool in the history of the world, and that may seem like a rather grandiose claim, but but I really believe that this technology is the same technology that Moses used in all of the miracles that we read about in the Bible.
Can you outline the technology a little bit? Just go over it?
Sure. Yeah. The Moses Code really begins with that conversation that Moses had at the burning bush when God asked him to accomplish what seemed absolutely impossible, which was to go to the most powerful man in the world, the Pharaoh, and demand the release of all of his slaves, the Israelites. And Moses, you know, that'd be like, you know, God asking you or I to go to George Bush and tell him that God wants him to, to pull all the troops out of Iraq.
Right, somebody off the street saying,
Yeah, we would probably think, you know, why have we been asked to do something that's crazy? But what Moses asked God was, well, who shall I say sent me? And God gave Moses the name, which in Hebrew is Ehye Asher Ehye, and in English is often translated to mean to be I am that I am. And we've heard that, most of us, in the past, but what I found is that there's actually a code at the center of that name that unleashes the power of the name of God and helps us to realize our oneness, as you were describing before, so that we can see that unifying factor. I'm sorry?
What's that code at the middle of that name? What is the code?
Well, the way that we practice it is as a chant. The name I am that I am, when we use it as a chant, is a way of number one, identifying ourselves as one with whatever it is we're trying to attract. We do that by saying, I am that. It's not that I'm going to claim that someday or I'm going to have that at some point. I think at the center of this is our willingness to look at that and to say, I am that now, whether it's abundance, whether it's peace, or whatever it might be. Mm. And then when we do this in the chant, we do this on the out-breath. We say, I am that. Mm. And we feel as if we already have that thing that we're claiming. And then as we breathe in, we breathe in the words, I am. So in doing so, in that the breath out and the breath in, we have said the name of God, I am that I am. And when we do this over and over again, focusing on whatever it is that we're attracting into our life, something really very powerful begins to stir. I can actually tell you of one experience that I had.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to prove this for myself. You know, I had been researching this and I had been writing about it already, but I didn't want to just put out another esoteric fantasy and as if, you know, there really isn't any substance to this. So what I did was about a year and a half ago, I had a book coming out called The Art of Spiritual Peacemaking. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe what I could do is I could use this chant or the Moses Code to try and make this book a number one bestseller in the world the day that it came out. I wanted to shoot for something really big because the fact is, of all the books I have ever published, not one of them has ever been a number one bestseller. So I figured if I could use the Moses Code, and if on the day that this book is released, it becomes a number one bestseller, then I'll know for sure that this is really something substantial. So what I did was I chanted with the Moses Code for about a month. Every day I would focus on this, and finally the day came for the book to be released, which was a year ago in June, and it started off on Amazon way, way high, and by the middle of the day, it was in the top 10, and finally, by the evening, by 9 o'clock that night, The Art of Spiritual Peacemaking became the number one best-selling book in the world, which, for me, was a miracle, and it was a sign that this is really something substantial. There is an energy, and there is a power when we chant the name of God as given to Moses, I am that I am, that we can not only use it to attract whatever it is we want, like it was expressed in The Secret, but that we can also use this power, this energy, to really change the whole world. And that's why we made this movie.
Well, that's amazing. But one of the things you said there, and I think at the core of the Jewish teaching, is just that very name of God, I am that I am, which places that divine force inside of us as the I am essence, as opposed to outside of us. So Moses, being the master shaman, prophet, teacher, had his own spirit talking to him in a sense when he said, "Who are you?" And his own essence said, you know, what's transcendent, which you talk a lot about in the film, the transcendence of the personality, is that I am presence. And that I am presence is the thing that does manifest everything that we want as
that's
personality.
Right. That's so exactly it. And as you know, this is not something that was just expressed through Moses or the Judaic tradition. This is something that we see in almost every tradition, in the Muslim tradition, in the Buddhist tradition. The teaching of the I Am presence is something that we find at the very heart. I think we just need to realize it now and to begin using that energy to do more than just get stuff that we think we want, but to use this to give what we need and what the whole world needs. And I think if we can do that, then we're going to see some major shifts on a very fundamental level.
But this is what I was saying about, you know, the exoteric versus the esoteric or the external. It's like if we can get the religions to see that their God is not, or people, you know, not the outside, you know, right or wrong, judgmental, dualistic
right.
God, but the internal I am essence, then that changes the paradigms of all
right.
the dogmas that people have been attached to for so
that's
long.
Right. And this is really what the mystical tradition is all about. This is what all of the mystics from whatever spiritual path have all experienced, that oneness and that the realization that the divine is within us.
Right.
And I think the power of the Moses Code is that it unlocks that power and it helps us to direct it. You know, it's one thing to have power, but it's another thing to be able to direct it responsibly and maturely. I think the problem in the world today is that we use that power irresponsibly and immaturely. And I'm hoping that that what began with The Secret and what continues now with the Moses Code is going to spark something that is going to help us to use the law of attraction to begin healing the world, which I think is in such desperate need of right now.
I mean, we can call it the law of attraction, but it's actually much, much bigger than that. It's a whole secret to incarnational soul lesson is really what's going on here. When you become the I Am that you're desiring, it is a manifestation in your reality as an extension of yourself. So I think calling it the law of attraction sort of, I mean, just reduces it to a kind of material form, and it's much,
I agree, yeah.
much bigger. It's really the teaching that all of us actually need to understand about who we are, you know. Because
one of the things that we call this and we talk about in the film is soul manifestation, or manifesting not from our ego, but from the longing of the soul, which is to unify, which is to experience oneness. And I absolutely agree with you. I think that calling the law of attraction, especially today, it limits it and it puts it in a little box. And what we're really talking about here is the creative force of the whole universe.
Right.
And, I mean, that's how big this is and how powerful this is. And, you know, this is not just like a... I'm sorry?
No, go ahead. It's not just a what?
I was just going to say that this is not just a nice little airy-fairy, new-age sort of fad that we're experiencing. Maybe we're finally beginning to understand the power that creates not only goods, but the whole field of opportunity that can create a whole new world.
Well, just if we go back to what you originally said, and which is the basis of the whole Moses Code, that I am that I am, that is the whole of all spiritual teachings. That is the transcendent state that goes
That's right.
beyond all our personal, I am that I am. That there's nothing more that, in a sense, we need to know after that, if we really
yeah,
get that.
Yeah, I know.
That.
Isn't that amazing?
That puts us in the present. That puts us... creating ongoing, or some people have translated that line in Hebrew, I am that which I am becoming also. That's I've heard another
yes.
translation like that. So
yes.
that brings everything right down to now in the essential creators that we are. Because
yes.
everything then in our reality is an extension of the I am that. And so,
it's pretty simple, isn't it?
So if we want something that we don't actually see in a reality, what I guess it was your discovery, your creation, that you say you substitute that essence, or you just pull it into you by saying, I am that, and then you fill in the blank. Is that basically?
That's right.
And then it has to materialize, because it's the law of the soul.
Well, it's I think the law that we need to really begin to not only understand today, but to practice. I think the more of us that can step into that I am presence at this critical time in human history, the better, because we do stand at the brink right now of either continuing to create a world of disaster or to turn things around and to create a world of immense opportunity. And I think that will happen as more and more of us understand exactly what you just described, that I am presence that's within us, and learning how we can direct it responsibly and maturely.
Huh. Yeah, and all the people you have in the... name some of the people. You know, James von Prague is in the film.
Yes, there's so many, from Debbie Ford to Andrew Harvey, both of whom played such a big role. Cheryl Richardson, James von Prague, Neil Donald Walsh, Joe Dispenza, John Holland, Sonia Choquette, Harville Hendricks, Greg Braden.
It's an all-star cast. These are the prophets and teachers of our time, and
yes,
they're all saying in that same essential thing, and it's, if everyone could hear that they are the I am presence, it would shift the world and bring power back to the individual. And
one person that we didn't mention, which I think is my favorite person in the film, and a lot of people have said the same thing, is Yelma Van Zandt, who I think is so brilliant the way that she describes exactly what you and I are discussing right now.
Oh, how does she just tell us how she describes it?
Well, she first of all has a very deep understanding of Moses, and when she talks about the I am, the name I am that I am, she says that I, the word I, is the creative force of the universe, and it has to be directed, and it's the I am. I am that. That's what directs that presence. And so when we focus on whatever it is that we want to create in our lives, whether it be compassion, abundance, peace, taking the I am presence and then directing it with that, she says that basically this is what created the whole universe to begin with. And as we then imitate that and learn how to direct that same force, that we become co-creators with God. And what greater thing could we do today?
The other thing about Moses that I've sort of put together as a sort of academic study is I think Moses took the hieroglyphics of Egypt and abstracted them into the Hebrew alphabet that the Phoenicians took and scattered around the Mediterranean. So I think Moses... that's my theory. Do you think something like that could have happened?
Well, you know what? Nothing like that would surprise me. I think that there is a richness to this story that we're just beginning to understand now. You know, this is a story that most of us have heard from the time we were little children, if we're Christian or Jewish or Muslim. And yet, you know, for us it's just a nice story about how God spoke to this guy named Moses and then he led him out of Egypt. But I think, like you're pointing out, there's probably a depth and a richness to this story that we can't even begin to comprehend yet.
Well, because Moses brought us and the essence of an abstract God forward, he needed an abstract writing that reflected the belief and the knowledge of what he was. So by changing those hieroglyphics, which were concrete images, to abstract forms, he planted in the mind the abstraction of an abstract God, which is, in essence, who we are.
Which really is, it brings us back to the name once again, because up until then, at least from that tradition, the divine or God did not have a name. It was just God Almighty or the God of Abraham. And from the moment that God told Moses, you know, I am that I am, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh, something I think very important happened. I think an intimacy with the divine was created through that story of Moses. And it's that intimacy which of course leads to oneness, that we're discovering today on deeper levels. And I think if we can do that, if we can continue to internalize that I am presence or the name of God, then the intimacy and the oneness with the divine is experienced on such deep levels that a world based upon the laws of compassion and love becomes the natural outpicturing, and it would happen on its own.
And I think Moses was that great soul that actually, I mean, this is my belief, ended the age of Taurus by burning the golden calf and initiated the age of Aries, I would say, by the age of the ram into the world. And that was a kind of a pivotal point when a great soul like that manifests in the world with a new teaching, and like
that's
Jesus
right.
did. Like right now, you know, I think the great teacher will be the essence in all of us. I don't think it's going to be one person coming forward in this new time. I think it's...
Totally agree with you. And I think that's one of the reasons why we want this movie and this book to be something that can be shared in a very new, revolutionary way. I remember when we first put the movie Indigo out, the mainstream distributors did not really believe that there was an audience for these kinds of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did was we went to churches and got them to turn their church into a theater for one night, and over 700 of them did, and Indigo became one of the highest grossing films of that month in North America. And mm-hmm. I think what we're going to do with the Most Code is something similar. On April 4th and 5th, there are going to be about 1,000 showings, primarily in people's homes. So people will be opening up their living room to a small group of people, and people will just be watching the film together on that day. And then on April 6th, what we're going to be asking is for people to activate the Moses Code. And we want to have an experiment where if we can get tens or hundreds of thousands on that one day activating the name of God and directing us, say, to the Middle East, which is what our focus is going to be on that day. I think it'll be very interesting to see what will happen. So if people want more information on that, or if they want to sign up to be a host themselves, they can go to themosescode.com, and there's all the information you could possibly need right there.
Well, it might be great just to stream it on the Internet through a web stream.
We will be doing that as well, because on that weekend, there'll be obviously a lot of people who won't want to or won't be able to go and see it with another group. So those who want to do it that way can go there that weekend and they can watch it online.
I let me know. Maybe I'll host something in New York here, you know.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Even with your friend Phil. He was just around for a while.
Oh, Phil Gruber, yes.
Phil Gruber. He said he was almost
in this film. Phil Gruber, you know, I'm sure you've probably had him on your show before.
He's hosted this.
Well, he is someone who has such a depth of understanding of this, and I really wanted him to be in the movie, but he was out of the country when we were shooting it, so he's very sad that he wasn't around, because I know he probably would have had a lot to say.
I know. He actually is pretty sad that he wasn't in the film, because it's a beautifully shot film. It's a beautiful production.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's really well done. So are you planning on being back in New York at all?
I'm not sure when, but yes, I am looking forward to coming back, hopefully sometime this year, and but it would probably be toward the end of the year. At the moment, there's nothing scheduled for me.
Where are you these days? Where are you?
Well, I live in Oregon, and I'm actually on a little vacation right now. As soon as I got the movie done, which was technically yesterday, we got the final little finishing touches done. I felt like I needed a little vacation, so I'm actually on the phone right now in Las Vegas.
Oh, in Las Vegas. Well, it's a great. One more question: was it you? You came up. The Moses Code. This I am chant came to you, huh? I mean, how
did
that happen?
Well, it did. It's one of those things that's difficult to take credit for, because I think this was a gift from God 3,500 years ago, but what happened, as you know, it was really, I think people knew that there was such power to this that, at least from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, the code was locked away and it has been considered to be blasphemous to actually say the name of God.
Say which name of God? Which the Asher, that name?
That is one of the names of God. There's Yahweh, and you know, which is actually something very interesting that I should mention, that you probably know of Jonathan Goldman, the sound healer, and you know, once again, this shows just how rich and how deep this can go. When I went to Jonathan at one point, and I asked him if there were any, if there was a way to take the name Ahia Asher Ahia and turn it into frequencies, and he said he would do some research, and he went to a very ancient form of Jewish numerology called Gematria. And what he did was he first figured out the Gematria for the name.
The number equivalent for the letters is the Gematria. Yeah.
Exactly. But what he did was he actually got two numbers, one for Ehiye and one for Usher. And he wanted to make tuning forks that would actually, you could listen to each one of them together. So he then had to bring these numbers in some sort of an approximate octave so that they would actually sound decent. So what he did was he took the lower number, which is, I think, the number for Usher, and he multiplied it into itself until it was in the same octave. And then once he did that, he did a reverse translation of the Ahia, Usher Ahia, and what he found was that when the number was changed, but then he did the reverse translation, it was another name of God. It was Yahweh, which I thought was very fascinating, that you could change the numbers, and yet it would still end up being another one of the Hebrew names.
That was
of
the Yud-Heh-Vud-Heh translation. That's interesting.
So, and then, of course, when he made the tuning forks, it was like listening to the angels sing, so... this is a very deep, very mystical truth that we're playing with here, and I'm hoping that people will see the movie and read the book, but most of all, begin to practice it in their own lives.
Well, can you just go over, I mean, right here as we kind of close, like, is there a chant that you created with this? How do you actually do it?
Well, the way I do it, let's say that there's something I want to attract into my life. You know, just for the sake of argument, let's say it's abundance.
Okay.
So the first thing that I do is I close my eyes and I feel the emotion of abundance. I feel what it would be like to have all of the abundance that I could possibly need.
Not the wanting of it, but the actual abundance. That's the confusion some people get. You don't want to feel the wanting. You want to feel what it feels like.
Exactly. Like if I had that right now, what would my emotion be? And what that does is it begins immediately to draw it into your energy. And then once I've done that, what I do is on my out-breath, I say, I am that. It's like saying, I am that abundance. And then as I breathe in, on my in-breath, I say, I am. So it's, I am that on the out-breath, and I am on the in-breath. And then what I do is I'll do it for 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll just keep focusing on drawing, you know, feeling that abundance and drawing it into my field. And what tends to happen is even just a couple of minutes of doing the chant, you begin to feel this amazing, very powerful energy surge through you, which
I
think is the creative. I'm sorry?
It is the creative form. But you say it out loud? You say the...
Yes. Out loud, I am that, and then it's kind of hard to do it over the phone, but as I breathe in, I say, I am. And what that is for me, you know, doing the chant like that is really like having a conversation with God. It's almost like I'm saying, I am that, and then God answers saying, I am. Which is, I think, a very important part of this code, because when God answers saying, I am, it's including that divine pulse with you. And in other words, God's not saying, you are. God's saying, I am. God is choosing that with you. And when you realize that God has chosen that abundance, whatever it might be, with you and as you, then the cycle becomes complete.
That, as you were talking, I really got that Moses really did give us a code.
It's amazing.
It's a code for the becoming of the God and being the creator of our destiny.
Yes, and it's what we so desperately need today.
So you feel that you feel what it's like to have your creation, whatever that would be,
right?
A partner, an abundance, a big house, or not to get too much into the secret stuff, but you, whatever it is, a spiritual enlightenment. And then you breathe it out as you say, I am that, because you're breathing out. You're acknowledging the feeling of what you've just created inside your own frequency, and then you breathe in the I am. So you're reaffirming it with the I am-ness again.
Right. It's so simple, and yet I'll just encourage people to practice with it, and I think just after 5 or 10 minutes, you're going to be absolutely amazed at how powerful this is.
I really get it. I really think you've discovered something, Jimmy. All these years of hard work have paid off. I mean, you've been at it a long time. It's from you know, your first book, The Emissaries of Light, to all the traveling and the peace playing and, you know, preventing war. You went to Iraq, right?
Three times now.
Did you meet Saddam Hussein as well?
Actually, the first time I went, which was back in 1998, I was supposed to meet him. That was the original intent, but he canceled the meeting, and we did not meet personally. But the concert that I did was broadcast on Iraqi television, and I was informed later that he did watch the concert.
Wow. So and then you've been all over the world. You went to Yugoslavia in the middle of that war, didn't you? I mean.
Yes. That's how it all started, actually, going to Bosnia and Croatia back in 1995.
I mean, just and chanting. People don't know you're an incredible songwriter, singer, guitar player. You're still doing that, right?
Oh yeah, that's, you know, for me, if there's one thing I couldn't stop, that I couldn't stop, it would have to be the music. I think it's really the core of who I am.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and sometimes I lose touch with that, you know, the books and the movies. But I think it's important for me to realize that at my heart, I'm the peace troubadour.
You're the peace troubadour. That's right, Jimmy Twyman, the peace troubadour. There's that beautiful woman in the film who's singing. Who is that?
Yes. Her name is Tina Malia, and she's singing the prayer of St. Francis, because I've of course, always loved that prayer, and I think that expresses this everything that we wanted to teach so beautifully, especially when it says, it is in giving that we receive, it is in loving that we are loved. I think this is really the very center of the Moses Code, that we have to give this. We need to give the essential qualities of our soul, and in doing so, we realize that we've always had everything that we could ever possibly want.
Right. Well, good luck with this. I mean, not good luck. I mean, this is for the planet. This is your gift for everyone.
Yes.
I mean, good luck for everyone.
Yes, and I hope we can get as many screenings as possible in New York, because I would just love to know that there are thousands of people seen it in New York that weekend.
Well, we will. So you think it's going to be sometime in April that we'll do it?
Yes, April 4th and 5th, once again, is are the days that it will be shown at about 1,000 different places. And if people want to get more information, just go to www.themosescode.com.
Themosescode.com. And I'll list it on my website, newrealities.com, because I'm listing all the spiritual events that happen all over New York.
And of course, people can go see a trailer of the film right now if they want. There's about a 5-minute excerpt from the film right there on the website.
On themosescode.com.
Yeah.
Great. Jimmy, and what's coming up for you? I mean, I know this was a lot of work, and it was
I'm not really sure. I'm just, the next year, really, is, I think, going to be out sharing this message. So I'm looking forward to getting the book and the movie out in both March and April, and then we'll just see where this takes us.
And what, with the book coming out in March?
Yes, the book will be out in early March, so people can always get that early, and then the movie will be out in early April.
It's a Hay House book?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I look forward to the book, the movie. I'll say hello to all your friends here in New York.
Please do, yes. And thank you so much for having me on the program.
Yeah, no, be in touch, and when you come back, we'll do a television show.
I would love that.
Yeah,
It's long overdue. We've been talking about this for about 10 years now.
I know we have, but at least we've done this.
That's right. Step in the right direction.
This is a great project. I think you really hit on something truly fantastic. And you're right.
You
it does
much.
The secret to a whole nother level.
Well, let's hope.
All right. right. Well, I wish I had one of your songs to end with. I'm going to end with that song here with by Chris Williamson. You know the song of the soul? It's an old song, and, you know, I think that song. You know that song?
Yes, I do. Love that song.
So thanks, Jimmy.
It's been an honor. I'll see you when I'm in New York next.
Definitely. I've been talking to Jimmy Twyman, the Peace Troubadour, and that's the best website for you. Is the Moses Code? The best website for you is themosescode.com, right?
The themosescode.com for the book and the movie, or they can visit my personal site with jamestwyman.com.
That's T-W-Y-M-A-N.
That's right.
Okay. Thanks, Jimmy.
You're welcome. Blessings.
This is New Realities with Alan Steinfeld. If you have any questions about this program or any ideas, suggestions, thoughts, please email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Please also check out my website, newrealities.com, where lots of the programs I've done here on bbsradio.com is listed. You can also go to bbsradio.com archives under New Realities and download all the shows I've done on this very nice station, very beautiful station, great people. I look forward to hearing from you, and definitely be in touch, and I'll be back next week.
Find you, truth will unbind you, look out and follow.